From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
My sense is there's ample evidence now that there has been a concerted campaign by the outgoing administration to sabotage the new administration.
That was Peter Laveau, the host of RT's flagship program Crosstalk, opening this Wednesday's edition of the program. It's entitled Trump versus Obama.
We've seen this with leaks that destroyed the career of Mr. Flynn, that is putting a lot of pressure on the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions. And now we have another claim from the other side of the aisle, as it were, in this battle. We have a sitting president saying the outgoing president was somehow involved or had knowledge of himself being, Donald Trump, being wiretapped. And a lot of evidence hasn't been really shown on any sides here, except for the fact that they don't want to go after the leakers. Maybe they will.
RT has been the target of U.S. media and of the U.S. intelligence services that have leaked reports claiming it has influenced American politics. For more on that, we spoke with Peter Laveau from his office in Moscow via Skype Wednesday. You're a star again in the American media, Politico quoting you, basically saying that the Russian media that lifted Trump to the presidency is now turning on him. And they take a quote of yours that says quite the opposite and use it to support their case, where you said if Joe McCarthy were alive today, he would easily recognize the witch hunt hysteria consuming Washington. And you pointed out blaming Russia is targeting Donald Trump, and the outcome of this is dangerously unclear. Let's talk about this.
One of the most important things is that I want to keep my eye on what's really happening without all of the spin. I mean, of course, spin is entertaining most of the time. When it comes to vilifying Russia, Vladimir Putin, and trying to try to tie President Trump and his associates to Putin, then, you know, this is no longer like a TV drama, House of Cards. This is really important stuff. What really bothers me is that there's so little evidence being shown to the public about these allegations. And let's take both sides of it, okay? Trump's connections to Russia and his associates. We had James Clapper on NBC, I think it was Meet the Press, and he was asked a direct question. Do you have evidence that the Trump team colluded with the Russians? And James Clapper said no. And he said it no more than one time.
Right.
To clarify the answer. I mean, I don't know what's going on here. And then you have the Trump team, you know, when you have President Trump coming out like at 5:30 in the morning saying that Obama spied on him. Well, that may be very true. Obama had a very long history of spying on just about everyone.
Right.
So fine. So both sides need to start showing some evidence here. And before we go on here, what I find amusing, because I've seen it so many times, either, you know, RT is such a powerful prop that it can change the world order and the history of mankind, or it's a marginal fringe news outlet. Well, you can't have it both ways, Don.
Right.
So I wish they would really make up their mind one way or another, because it's not going to change how I do my job.
Yeah, of course not. You know, you've got a condition here where coming into the election season, you know, as a consequence of the immediate and recent history of events in the United States and in the world, where there was a crisis of legitimacy that was a driving dynamic of the election. You saw that in the rise of Bernie Sanders in the Democratic primaries, and that being reified by the illegitimate theft of the primaries, more or less in the open, by the Clinton campaign, and the rise and ultimately the election of Donald Trump. And in the midst of this crisis of legitimacy, the entrenched interests here who view Trump as a threat, and it has to be said that the only real divergence in terms of policy between Trump and what's happened before has to do with the thinking of the relationship between the United States and Russia, and the idea of the U.S. role in the world being, you know, empowered to commit regime change wherever it's decided is in the national interest of the United States. That is really the only distinguishing thing about Trump, and we don't even know if that's actually his essence or just some campaign promises that were made and a few acts that he's taken as president. So what you have is a condition of people rejecting the institutions of power in the United States generally and at the ballot box, an attack on the President of the United States that's wall-to-wall, an attack on Russia as being an evil player inside the United States and in Europe that's wall-to-wall inside the media, the installation of the material means of conducting war with Russia and China over the past 5 years, more or less from the Baltics to the Korean Peninsula, and we've had the THAADs now installed in South Korea, for example. It's a pretty dangerous cocktail, and people are, you know, more or less going out into the streets to push it over the precipice, and I'm wondering where this lands when it finally hits the ground.
One explanation for it all is that you really need a terrifying, ugly monster of amazing proportions to somehow justify why the Democrats lost the election.
Right.
I think that's really explains it.
Right.
You couldn't say Ecuador was played a key role in the overthrow of the American political establishment. Right. That wouldn't work. Angola, the key to the American political system, that wouldn't work either.
Right.
So where do you go? China will, you know, as much as people want to criticize China, and legitimately sometimes when it comes to its export policies, nobody really wants to take on the Chinese because they all like their iPhones, all right? So it's kind of like a default position. And you and I have spoken so many times about this. It is just out of force of habit. The number of people that come on my program, and this is not a criticism, this is an observation that I'm making, that say the Russians did it, or the Politburo, Putin's government. It's part of our DNA. It's easy to activate too. It's very easy to activate. And then, you know, when you take a look at real hotspots, meaningful conflicts here, let's just take two of them, Ukraine and Syria. And Russia is involved directly and indirectly in both these conflicts here. And American power with its allies has been thwarted in both places. And that's something that, you know, we weren't brought up to believe. How is that possible? There must be something nefarious going on because we're trying to help these people. We're trying to bring democracy to these people, which is patently obviously not true.
Right.
But, you know, it really bumps up against a multifaceted narrative that people just can't get their head around. And we had a guest on last week on Crosstalk from Berkeley. And he was an anti-war activist. I really don't know if he was from the left or right. I didn't get any impression one way or another. But he was really very passionately anti-war. And he told me he went to a town hall. And, you know, there was, being Berkeley, very strong concerns about Trump. And then he said, you know, Russia was brought up. And the whole place went up to the rafters saying, yes, the Russians must be involved. This must explain why this is going on. And that's when you have a system that has completely short-circuited itself. Again, either IT is all powerful or it's on the margins, you know. And you really have to think the same thing. I mean, if America is the greatest country in the world because of its values, how can it be threatened by any idea or power if you believe the country at its very foundations is good, strong, and a message to the world? Again, there's a glaring contradiction, and no one in the mainstream media even wants to get close to that area to try to explain it.
You know, just in terms of the media here, by the way, even the so-called progressive media, I'm going to talk particularly about an interview that I saw, a debate of sorts on Democracy Now! A couple of days ago on the question of Russia's role in the United States election and connections to the Trump White House and Trump campaign. And you had on one side Scott Horton, who was introduced as a law professor at Columbia Law School, and Robert Parry, the journalist. And what wasn't disclosed while they were talking about Russian interference in the U.S. elections, in essence, regime change conducted by Russia in the United States, that's how some people actually frame it, Scott Horton was actually involved in regime change in the Soviet Union. He represented some of the most famous dissidents at the time that the Soviet Union came down. He was one of the people that were on the ground pushing against the Soviet establishment. And that wasn't mentioned at all. And it, to me, seems like it's something that would frame it.
You know, it's really interesting when you bring up progressives and all that. And I think Glenn Greenwald, I think that's what he likes to consider himself, if not a a liberal Democrat. He came out with an article in The Intercept. And, and a lot of the investigative stuff that comes out of The Intercept, I think, is worthy of reading and commenting on and even sharing. But he came out with an article, I guess it was yesterday, and he was commending a Russian journalist, Masha Gessen, for saying, wasting all our time on this anti-Russian stuff and anti-Putin stuff. We're missing what's really important, civil liberties, protection of basic rights and freedoms and all that. And I thought, well, Glenn's making a very interesting point, but I was so disappointed with such a smart guy. Is that if he just dug a little deeper, Masha Gessen is one of the reasons why there's such an anti-Russian hysteria in the United States. I mean, when I was growing up, where I wanted to be published, where I wanted to work, was a New York Review of Books, because I thought that was just a cat's meow. And then I read it now, and when it's coverage of Russia and other things that are of interest to me, it's just slop. It's just activists. Bias, it's outrage, it's more emotion than thinking, and that's so terribly disturbing. And you bring up Robert Perry, and I'm going to go take a look at that, because Robert Perry has been remarkably consistent in his coverage, particularly of Ukraine. I don't know. I don't know if Amy Goodman was moderating it, but if I'd been in that moderating position, I think I really would know where to go, because I think both of these gentlemen, I'm Scott Horton, he's the same one associated with antiwar.com, correct?
I think he writes there.
All right. I mean, some of his stuff is okay, too. But I think that, let's bring up another media character, Tucker Carlson.
Yeah.
Really good stuff. As your listeners know, I call myself coming from the a cultural conservative, so obviously I can identify with Tucker Carlson. But I sense, and this is only my opinion, this is, I'm not making a statement of fact here, but I think even he knows the limits of questioning the narrative about Russia and the election. You could see it, like, in my mind, his pushback will just go to a certain point, because right. Then he will be the only voice in mainstream media that is a complete dissenter. Though he does question a lot, he mocks a lot. He was even accused by one guest of, you should go work for RT, which, of course, everyone at RT picked that up, and we were all very proud of it.
he's the only talk show host in mainstream American media that's ever had me on. When he was at MSNBC, he had me on talking about a piece I had written in 2007 advocating that Hillary Clinton get primaried by Cindy Sheehan for her seat in the Senate.
I saw it. It was good. And he was fair to you.
Yeah, he was. Yeah. I mean, we disagreed, but we had an animated discussion about it. But yeah, he was fair. And he also was dealing in facts and not, rhetorical claptrap, which is what.
This WikiLeaks release is, it's absolutely fascinating and quite terrifying. I mean, I've spent most of today going through the details, and it's. A lot of us imagine these kind of things, but when it's confirmed, still shakes you in your boots.
What's interesting about it, you mentioned Ecuador not being a significant player, but actually on April 2nd, when they choose the president of, Ecuador, of the second round of elections, the question of Julian Assange's fate is squarely on the table. The right-wing candidate has promised to kick him out of the embassy, and this is looming over WikiLeaks right now as they come out with this expose of the CIA.
And we both know, Don, and your listeners know, that America has never intervenes in the elections of Ecuador. Oh, God forbid ever that happens. Okay. My goodness, the naivety of people. But with this WikiLeaks dump, it seems very clear. Smart people that know about these things, I've been reading their commentary on the leaks, and this whole chasing Russian ghosts can easily be put to rest. I mean, we do have see now that the CIA has the ability to basically put somebody else's fingerprints on a hack. Okay,
right.
It's very obvious. Okay, and we know from people like McGovern, the former CIA advisor.
Oh, Ray McGovern.
Ray. You know, he and his colleagues, smart people. Well, I think someone said once they have on his team they have about 200 years of experience. Okay, that's something to take seriously. What happened with Podesta and Clinton and the DNC, it was a leak. It wasn't a hack. Somebody gave it to Julian Assange.
Right.
Simple as that. That's what, you know, usually the simplest explanation is the right one here. And one of the narrative, part of the narrative that no one never addresses directly because it's almost impossible to, how about transmission? How did the Russians get these emails? How did they transmit it to WikiLeaks? You know, I think American intelligence spends $800 billion a year. I mean, someone will have to fact check me on that.
Yeah,
but as Ray McGovern and his colleagues have made it very clear that the NSA can find out about transmission. Well, they think this is not hard to do, and they have no evidence of it, probably because there was no means of transmission. Okay, somebody put it on a flash stick and, you know, FedExed it to Julian Assange.
Right.
I mean, and who knows? That might be the whole trail right there.
Yeah, I know. And as a matter of fact, as anyone knows who's used FedEx, you can trace the entire trip that a document takes from the time it's dropped off at a box to when it's transshipped to one of their centers for distribution, when it's on the truck on its way to your house, and when it arrives. And so it's really not hard to figure out by looking at the barcode where it came from.
What else is not hard to understand? And this is where my intensive criticism of the mainstream media is that they failed. They no longer do their job because they've gotten so used to being in bed with power, the fame, the fortune, everything. They're so wedded to power now is that there is no way in the world you're going to stand up and challenge the official narrative, okay? And when I was a small kid, I mean, you and I are closer in age than the people I work with.
Right, right.
You know, it took Walter Cronkite and people like Walter Cronkite to say to the American people, let's face the truth. This war is not going to be won in Vietnam.
Yep.
And we have to question even our moral stance now regarding this war. We don't have any Walter Cronkites at all. We have Tucker Carlson, but he's challenging everybody. OK. And then you have like Sean Hannity, which, you know, domestically I can get along with him more or less. But when he goes into foreign policy, he's in Lululand.
Yeah.
Again, the establishment mantra is there. And this is why we get into this situation is because the fourth estate is not doing its job. And this is an amazing disservice to the American people, and I would say to the for the world as it was indirectly. I mean, for example, Don, how many people know if you go up to the street with a microphone with them and say, "Do you know that there's a war going on in Yemen?" And I bet you most people don't really have a clue. Do you know that the United States is actively abetting the medieval regime of Saudi Arabia that is committing? Certainly is ethnic cleansing and may even be genocide in Yemen. Most people would not have a clue whatsoever at all.
You know, it's been a year or better since the first reports came in. That was maybe at the end of the first year of the Saudi airstrikes on Yemen, that something like 9 million people were food and medicine distressed and internal refugees. They were, the infrastructure of the country was laid waste by the Saudi Air Force with the guidance, the target information from U.S. AWACS, because they don't hand the AWACS out. They keep control of them. So the U.S. is directing
them. One of the poorest countries in the world.
That's right.
Okay? I mean, and it's being crushed by one of the richest countries in the world. And when there are stories about it, I dare say, Don, is that it's Iran's fault. That's why you write the story, right? You write it because you want to throw in Iran's fault. Iran is aiding and abetting the Houthi and all of that. We don't have any evidence of that. We don't. It is, again, an evidence-free environment to make these accusations. And that's why it's so easy to swallow. There's so many other examples around the world. What's going on in Ukraine? Ukraine isn't mentioned very much anymore, is it? No, because it's failure. They failed to do what they wanted to do. The country is disintegrating. It's turning into, as the Saker wrote yesterday, it's turning into the Somalia of Europe. Is that what Europe really needs right now? Oh, of course, it's Russia's fault. Because if you take this narrative that it's always Russia's fault, you can always find a way to tie Russia into everything. It's really extraordinary. And I think most of all, and this is what the listeners have to understand, is that this mentality is destroying institutions in America. America perfected and its allies regime change around the world. Well, Don, regime change has come to America, all right? And they're playing by the same playbook. Look what they did to Yanukovych. They're doing exactly the same thing to Trump right now. They have great experience in overturning regimes, and now they're going to try it in Washington.
Yeah, it's the chickens coming home to roost, as Malcolm X put it.
Yep.
Looking at the situation that exists on the ground in some of these places, like in Yemen, we have seen a change in U.S. policy under the Trump administration, an acquiescence at least to the facts on the ground in Syria, and a focusing of the U.S. military efforts genuinely against ISIS and Al-Qaeda there. Also, the media reaction to the attack on Al-Qaeda in Yemen that was treated as if it were some sort of human rights catastrophe committed by the Trump administration, actually representing a shift in policy from AWACS-guided Saudi attacks on the population to U.S. military attacks against Al-Qaeda, because the Saudi Air Force, with U.S. guidance, was operating in exactly the same way as the U.S. and NATO did in Libya as the Air Force for the Al-Qaeda ground troops. And now that policy has changed. And we see this massive media response that doesn't mention what I just described, which are the facts on the ground, but rather talks about civilian casualties and this being, and of course, the loss of an American soldier, and this being some offense committed by the Trump administration. It's a total reframing of reality.
Yeah, but it's really interesting. It's actually giving light to a reframed reality, because there was never any criticism that I could see of the Obama administration's support of this horrific war in Yemen. And then as soon as you get Donald Trump in, this is an opportunity to beat him with another stick here. This is, again, appalling. I mean, it has nothing to do with the suffering of a people that are just defending themselves. I mean, they're not going to invade Saudi Arabia. What the media does is they just say, we can pick on the new administration for this, when there is absolutely no context provided to the public of how this war started and developed and continues. It's just a reframing for public relations. That's all. I find that really pathetic. War is the ultimate worst thing to happen to a people.
Yeah. Some of the other examples of this change in U.S. policy. Well, I want to go to Ukraine, because, not only has there been a failure of U.S. policy there, but in an obvious attempt by Poroshenko and by the right sector and some of those other maniac Nazi groups on the ground, they began again last month. I've interviewed Mikhail Puertas, who's at Donetsk National Polytechnic University in Donetsk. They started firing ballistic missiles into the city center. They took out some apartment blocks with hundreds of deaths and other, maybe 1,000, 2,000 casualties. The university itself was struck. This is a completely disproportionate level of activity to people that are essentially saying we reject the coup government and we're going to govern ourselves with the structures more or less that existed before in the state of Ukraine, which was more or less a confederation.
Yeah, well, what you have is slowly but surely now. The Russian ruble is the currency used in what's called Novorossiya. The authorities, local authorities, have nationalized all of the enterprises, meaning Kiev is not going to get paid anymore. Number three, the Donbass and Novorossiya are not going to be paying taxes anymore. Flip on the other side of the coin, Russia now is recognizing all of the official documents of the people in the Donbass, Novorossiya, like their birth certificates,
driver's licenses,
the basic things you need for life. Because when you want to get that kind of stuff renewed, you have to go to Kiev. What's happened here is that essentially Kiev is demanding that these people go on alone without Kiev. I mean, this is really the result of their policy. We have militias without any kind of oversight from the government. They have actually created a border now between Ukraine proper and Novorossiya. It wasn't the Ukrainian army that did it, not the Ukrainian authorities. Right. It was these militias. Right. So and then they put up a blockade, and so they can't get the Donbass, Novorossiya cannot export coal, for example, but there's an energy crisis in Ukraine.
Right. I mean, this was created. What's interesting is
you can't make it up. Okay. Yep. And so what's happened is that out of necessity, the people of these two besieged republics have had to make a choice. And so we have codified today a frozen conflict that never, ever should have happened. And it's all Kiev's fault and their Western backers. Of course, you'll get to hear, you know, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. It's because Russia won't fulfill the Minsk agreements. Well, Russia is not part of the Minsk agreements except for to be there as more of a witness, as a guarantor. Right. Read it. It's really a one pager. Russia is not a party of it. It is a guarantor of it. Okay, Russia is not involved in that conflict.
And finally, the Professor Puertas told us, you know, with respect to what you just raised about the militias, you had a condition before where the oligarchs that are based in Kiev, who owned the mines that produced the coal that the factories in the West run on, and that coal apparently is specific, you know, these factories, the economy, the manufacturing sector in general, and the heating apparatus, all of these things work on this particular type of coal. The scrubbing doesn't work on other types of coal. The temperature isn't right to fire engines and all of that. And what happened was, the oligarchs were still getting paid. They were paying the workers to do the mining, and the coal was flowing to Ukraine. And this was a tacit agreement between the local governments in Donbass and Kiev. And it was the right sector and these other militia groups that interdicted that flow and forced the conditions that exist now, the nationalization of the mines, the cessation of payments to the oligarchs in Kiev, and the deprivation of the Ukrainian, quote-unquote, the Western Ukraine economy of the fuel source that it runs on.
You know, the Western narrative, it's Russia's meddling in Ukraine. Nothing could be further from the truth, okay? I mean, it's the actions of the government in official Kiev, that's what I call it. And then you have these militias here. This is an internal Ukrainian problem that is only getting worse. And the poor people of the Donbass have no other recourse but to see Russia as a friend. You know, everybody should understand is that, I've said this on your program before, these are ethnic Russians, Russian-speaking people, most of them are Orthodox Christians. I mean, obviously, they see Russia as like them, and Russians see them as the same as well. And so what we've done is it's created a buffer state in a way. It's very easy to get into Donbass from Russia. But for people in the Donbass to go to Kiev, nominally in their own country, it's now virtually impossible because it's all blockaded off. And when the economy continues to deteriorate, now you're going to have these right-wing militias. They're going to turn on official Kiev, and then you're going to have part two of the Ukrainian civil war. And you know what? It doesn't look like the Trump administration is too interested in it. It's cut the allocation to armaments and training to half, 50% down. And you know what? It's going to be the Europeans are going to have to pick up the tab because Russia certainly won't. So this is what we get from an illegal coup against a democratic government. It's really absolute lunacy, but we've seen it before.
Peter, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, as always.
Thank you very much.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.